Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Tristan and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 161 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell. Alongside me, Johnny Stofko.
What's up, guys? What's up, Tristan Cannell? 161, the Vision Board. Who are we bringing in?
We've got a nutrition killer today. We've got Dr. Jose Antonio.
He's kind of like a maverick and a pioneer, not, you know, PhD, started and founded the ISSN sports nutrition whiz, man. We're stoked to learn from this guy.
Yeah, he's been mentioned by a couple of our previous guests in Dr. Corey Peacock and also Chris Algieri. So, you know, he comes very well recommended. We've both been checking him out a lot over the last kind of 18 months. And what he's done with the ISSN has really brought a great, you know, great group of people together, and I think their future is very, very bright, and it's going to educate the world.
For sure. It's about, with Dr. Jose Antonio, it's about highlighting the importance and the relevance of the caloric intake, what we're eating, how we're eating, when we're eating, all of those extraneous variables in relation to our performance. And this guy deals with the highest level of educators, coaches, teachers, and athletes. So imagine the conversations that he's used to on a day in and day in basis. Sure. So this is an awesome opportunity for you guys to share with Tristan and I that sort of space. And that's where we're evolving. As you said, he's evolving as well. And man, we've been hearing for what, last year and a half of his name keep popping up. So we're stoked to bring this.
Yeah. So this is how the interview is going to kind of go today. So it's a little bit different to the normal ones we do. So we're going to launch into more of an ISSN feel, just to feel what ISSN is all about and where he wants to take it for that first kind of 15, 20 minutes. And then me and Johnny are going to start spitting some Q&A sort of style questions that we think are going to be very valuable that you guys can actually execute and bring into your lifestyle straight away.
Yeah, guys, an ISSN acronym is International Society of Sports Nutrition. We have a lot of coaches listening to the show. All my clients listen to the show, as does yours. So it's not just a one-sided affair either, as you mentioned. It's not just from the maestro, from the teacher giving, but we're also getting common day questions from our clients. And we're going to touch base on a lot of different topics here. Another one of these ones, we probably need 5 hours with Jose. But an hour is what we got, and you know, I'm sure we're going to fill it with the highest quality of content.
Yeah, before Jose comes on, guys, big shout out to everyone checking out the show, leaving us messages of support via iTunes or email. We really appreciate it. And if you haven't yet, please share it with your family and friends. It just helps us grow, and we can reach more people and get the message out of guys like Jose.
Yeah, tell your friends about listening to the Vision Board on iTunes and SoundCloud. It takes a few moments to subscribe. We appreciate everyone who's tuning into this and everyone who's supporting us since jump. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. So without further ado, here is Dr. Jose Antonio. All right, our special guest is Dr. Jose Antonio. He is the CEO and co-founder of the International Society of Sports Nutrition. Dr. Antonio is an assistant professor of exercise and sports science at Nova Southeastern University in beautiful South Florida, and he's completed a PhD and postdoctoral research fellowship at the University of Texas Southwestern in Dallas, Texas. Welcome, Dr. Jose Antonio. Jose, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, guys, for inviting me to the Vision Board Podcast. And I did want to talk to you a little bit about the history of the ISSN. And let's hope I'm coming in loud and clear from beautiful South Florida, where it's sunny and warm all year.
Dr. Jose, let's get this started. I was in America this past June, and I was getting messages from, you know, Dr. Corey Peacock, Chris Algieri, about the 2017 version of the ISSN in Arizona. Could you share with our listeners listening to this episode a little bit about what the ISSN is, and when you guys gather together, what's happening there?
We founded the ISSN in 2003, and the primary reason we did it was most academic organizations really treated sports nutrition as sort of the black sheep of the family. It got no respect. People thought the science wasn't there. But myself and actually just a few colleagues thought otherwise. You know, we thought, you know what, there's some good stuff here. Sure, there's not a lot of science yet, but the only way you get science is you get scientists involved. And so our goal was to promote the science and application of sports nutrition and try to pull in not only the academic people, but also athletes, people in the industry who sold products, sports nutrition products, so that, you know, if you get a marriage of industry and science, I think that's the best way to get people exposed to the science. And so we just had our last conference in Phoenix. That was the 14th annual conference. And we have a lot of fun at the conference. I mean, not only is there great science, but the networking is great. And everyone mentions how nice everybody is. And probably one of the most fit crowds. If you go to any science conference, we probably have the people who are in the best shape, as odd as that is. But everyone's a workout fanatic. So I'd say for most of them, sports nutrition is something not only they do professionally, but let's face it, a lot of it is people want to see what helps them. You know, whether it's putting more weights, whether it's looking better, whether it's running faster. You know, what can I take that will help me perform better? And I think that's sort of one of the selfish reasons people go to sports nutrition is like, hey, how can I make myself better? So, but I'm telling you, you guys need to come to our conference next year. It's in Clearwater Beach, Florida, one of the most beautiful beaches in Florida. And we have a grand old time. So I highly encourage all of your friends to come.
Yeah, Dr. Jose, thanks for the invite. It's definitely on the calendar. I wanted to talk about, you know, for the average person listening, when we hear sports nutrition, are we speaking about specifically the food going into our bodies during like a specific sport? Is there any specificity regarding sport to sport? And then the word sports tackled on with nutrition, is that like an energy expenditure equating to like specifically athletes?
Yeah, you know what's interesting? If you talk to the average person about sports nutrition, to me, it's actually not truly sports nutrition. It's what I call physique nutrition. Almost everybody, when they talk about sports nutrition, they talk about what can I take to lose fat and gain muscle? It's almost always bodybuilding. You know, how can I look better? To me, that's actually not sports nutrition, although it's sort of a subset of it. To me, that's called physique nutrition. To me, sports nutrition is what you consume, whether it's a food, whether it's a supplement, whether it's a fortified food, what you can consume that will help you do a sport, let's say football, basketball, baseball, volleyball, you know, pick your sport, help you perform better. And to me, the body composition issue, whether you gain muscle mass, whether you lose fat mass, that's actually a secondary issue for sports. Because let's face it, the goal of sports is to win, not to look pretty. I mean, you might be the prettiest one out there, but if you get your ass beat, you know, what's the point, right? You know, so there's really sort of these two camps. And a lot of people think of sports nutrition as physique nutrition, when in fact, they're actually a bit different.
Doctor, what is the starting point when an athlete comes and sees you?
Starting point is this. I always say, what's your goal? And depending on the athlete, I mean, if they're, let's say, at the college level or the world-class level, their goal is always to win. You know, my goal is to do better. If you're dealing with the recreational athlete, almost always their goal is to look better.
Yeah.
You know, I've always thought looking better is sort of an odd goal because no one's ever happy with the way they look. They could always get better, but they're never happy because they always want to look better all the time. And so, to me, that's a tough one, especially, you know, when you work with women particularly, I think they're very hard on themselves and they're never satisfied with how they look. So you could be working with them. They could be getting better looking, losing fat, gaining a little bit of muscle, reshaping their bodies, and they're still unhappy. You know, so I prefer working with those who have a performance goal, because a performance goal is easily measurable. You either win or you get second or you get third or whatever, or you get faster or you get stronger. There's things that are measurable. And that's, I think, where sports nutrition can play a great role.
I was reading an article about, so the fitness industry and wellness industry in Australia, it's one of the few places on earth that the average person, the general public, has money to invest in their general well-being. So with personal training, strength coaching, because of this, Dr. Jose, you start seeing a lot of experts popping up in everything. Maybe not with the credential, you know what I mean? Maybe not with the credentials that you have.
Yeah.
And my question arises on, so our listeners listening at home, the clients who are kind of leaning on the shoulders of not nutritionists and not doctors giving them nutritional advice and writing meal plans, could you talk about a little bit of the dangers in that when you seek outside, less professional help in regards to your nutrition?
Yeah, this, you know, I had a conversation with someone about, because there's always quacks and there's always charlatans out there who But let's face it, oftentimes, if you go on Instagram, oftentimes it's a good-looking girl, and she gives advice, and she's a total dumbass, okay? Mm. But nobody knows that because most people don't know the science. So they're like, oh, wow, she's great-looking, and I like the way, you know, I like the way she looks, so she must give good advice. Now, interestingly, I actually take a different take on that than a lot of people. I always say, you know what? It actually doesn't bother me. In a way, it entertains me. And in the end, consumers need to sort of make the decisions that are right for themselves. They need to do the homework. They need to get educated to see who actually knows this stuff and who doesn't. And if they get sort of hooked in by, you know, a quack or someone who's fake, you know, some con artist, in a way, it's partly their fault because they didn't do their homework. Now, is it easy to do your homework on someone? It isn't, actually. And that's the thing. It's, you know, I was talking to one of my PhD friends, and you know, if you look at sports nutrition as a science, there might be 50 scientists, maybe 100 in the world. That's it, in the world. Wow. So you're not going to find many scientists to begin with. Okay, so if you can't find scientists, who would be the next person? Well, it could be people who work for a sports team, you know, as a sports nutritionist or a sports dietitian. But even then, some of them give stupid-ass advice. I'll tell you that right now. It's just like, what? Where the hell did you get that? So it is difficult for the consumer. And I think this is one of the challenges we have as ISSN. It's like, how do we educate enough people so that they can spread the word about, you know, evidence-based sports nutrition? But, you know, these people who parade around as experts, that's just part of the category. Sometimes it bothers me. A lot of times I just laugh. But we, you know, people of us, those of us who work in the field, do research in the field, work with athletes, it's really our job to show that we're better because we don't really have time to, you know, to sort of sift out all of these people who are giving bad advice.
Jose, what's the biggest point of difference for the ISSN? You know, we just spoke about these Instagram models that don't know anything. What's the encouragement for them to take your course instead of something else?
I think the best thing is that we are the only organization. We actually provide a certification that's actually created by sports nutrition scientists who not only do the research, but also are ones who work with athletes. So a lot of people view scientists as people who are just stuck in the lab, which is really odd because at least in sports nutrition, it's actually the opposite. Not only in the lab, but all of them, all of my friends work with athletes. And they were either former athletes or still competitive today. So sports nutrition is a lot different than other fields of science. Where other fields of science, scientists might be isolated. In our field, you have to be involved with athletics because, you know, talking theoretical training, it's like, who cares? I mean, you have to implement, you know, what you learn in terms of training or sports nutrition. So we all work with athletes. And I think ISSN, if you want evidence-based or just pure, just really great science in terms of, you know, it helps you make decisions, not only for yourself as an athlete, but when you're counseling your athlete, it helps you make decisions. It's, you know, it's what I call sort of the bullshit meter. You'll know if someone's BSing you. And I tell my students all the time, when I have a research class, an exercise physiology class, and I teach a sports nutrition class, I tell them, I said, look, don't believe me because I'm telling you. I don't want you to do that because then you're just a parent. You're stupid. You're just going to repeat what anyone tells you. I said, believe me only if you look at the data and you see, oh, so that's how he arrived at that conclusion. He's not just making stuff up. And ultimately, when people come to ISSN, they learn how to look at the data. They know how to look at a study and say, okay, that sort of makes sense. Or maybe it doesn't quite make sense. And that's okay, too. I mean, things are not always black and white, particularly when you're working with athletes. So I think, you know, learning how to think critically, learning how to read scientific data is important. And that's why I encourage people to go to ISSN, because I always say, hey, it can never hurt to be smarter than this. I mean, if anything, it's going to help everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jose, you said, so first off, I want to say congrats, man. You said 2003 was your first year of the ISSN, and you just,
yes. You
just celebrated your 14th. So
yes.
Like, yeah, congrats, man. 14 years, you know, consistent, gathering the brightest minds in that industry. That's pushing other industries forward in regards to science-based evidence, specifically with performance. But let's talk a little bit about hindsight. If, like, in 2003 and 2004, those first couple years, and then what you guys talked about this past June, talk a little bit about, you know, the evolution of your vision and the evolution of, you know, just sports nutrition overall in the last 14 years?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question because, let's see, 14 years ago, how old were you?
14 years ago, I was 21. I was a sophomore in college at University of Pittsburgh.
Okay, you were at Pitt.
Yeah, I went to Pitt.
Okay. I got my PhD in 1993.
Wow.
I got my...
We couldn't tell.
You look very young.
Yeah, we couldn't tell from the video.
I had no idea how old you were.
Yeah, Tristan was like, Dr. Jose's probably like 40. I was like, he's a PhD.
I've got a lot of Filipino friends where I live, and they are the youngest looking people ever.
Yeah, it's. I always tell people it's my Asian genes. It's hard to tell how old I am other than my hair's falling out because I have kids. but you know, it's okay. I got my, just to give you some background, I got my bachelor's degree in biology in 1984. I got my master's degree in exercise physiology in 1986. And then I got my PhD not quite 5 years later in the early 90s in skeletal muscle physiology. That was in the early 90s. So going back to the 1980s when I was in grad school, I actually loved sports nutrition. This is what's funny. Mm. The reason I loved it is I loved reading the muscle magazines because that's all there was. I'm like, hey, this stuff's kind of cool. These guys get really big. I mean, we all know they're on drugs, but who cares? They get really big. And I'm like, wow, this stuff is cool. They eat protein, they take amino acids, and there's no science. And I thought, wow, well, I can't really do a dissertation on it because there's nobody really studying it. So that's why I chose to study muscle physiology for my PhD, even though I love sports nutrition. But I always thought, you know what? If there's a way to get back into sports nutrition, I will. And it wasn't really until the late 90s that sports nutrition started to pick up because something called creatine was founded in the early, it was first talked about in the early 90s. So it was actually the supplement creatine that created the boom in academics. You're like, huh, wow, this supplement actually does quite a bit of stuff.
Mm.
And so you go back to the year 2000, sports nutrition still wasn't, it wasn't a field of study. I mean, very few people looked into it, except maybe two of us. That was myself and Jeff Stout. Jeff Stout is at University of Central Florida now. And everyone thought, that stuff's a waste of time. No one cares about that crap. Sports nutrition's bullshit, blah, 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 blah. And we're like, wow, these people, I think they're all wrong.
Yeah.
We're just like, wow, they're just all wrong. And so, to sort of make a long story short, Jeff Stout and I gave a talk at the American College of Sports Medicine. This was like in the early 2000s. And let's just say they were not fans of us. Let's just say they got really mad and they started calling us names because we talked about sports nutrition and supplements. Oh. And it was at that moment, it was just funny. I kind of enjoyed how the audience was very hostile to us. I'm like, wow, they really hate us. This is really kind of strange. And it was at that moment I said, you know what? They're not very good at promoting sports nutrition science because they're so biased against it. I mean, the Academy, the American Dietetic Association, biased against this. American College of Sports Medicine, they were biased against it. And so in the early 2000s, we're like, you know what? We should do this ourselves because apparently no one thinks sports nutrition is a field, a legitimate field. And here's the ironic part. You fast forward now to 2017. Every college has a sports nutrition course. Everyone wants to study sports nutrition. You cannot get away. You cannot go to any major college in the U.S. without someone teaching a sports nutrition course. Hell, in my own college, we have two courses.
Wow.
20 years ago, that didn't exist because sports nutrition wasn't a category. So it's just weird. And literally a little over a decade, we've gone from sports nutrition sucks. It's not a real field to like, oh, sports nutrition is not the cool thing, which is like, I'm like, wow, how ironic, you know. For a while there was just really a couple of us who cared about it. Now it's like everybody wants to do it.
Yeah.
So in a way, we won, you know, we lost the battle, but we won the war. In the end, it's like we won, you know. Sports nutrition is a great field.
You were like the presario, like the you and Jeff are like the Mozarts of sports nutrition because you're saying when you guys were speaking on it, you were deemed as heretics, and now – it's like you said, there's two sports nutrition courses in your university.
Yep, exactly. And you go to any major school, and a lot of students now want to study it for their PhD. It's actually really cool.
Yeah, Jose, who was behind?
I was going to say this. You know what? Let me tell you a quick story. When we first started ISSN, maybe 50 people showed up for the conference because nobody studied sports nutrition. Well, here's the funny part. So since 2003, some of my friends have had students graduate. Those students have had students graduate. So we've seen three generations of students start showing up at ISSN. You know, people who are formerly students are now professors who are graduating students. So it's like, wow, it's like I'm getting really old and everyone's getting really young. This is really kind of strange.
Yeah. Like, so you brought up, you name dropped a year. You said 2000, and you know, 2000's been like a pinnacle year in my life's timeline, because that's when I graduated high school. And I played football, baseball, and basketball. And if sports nutrition wasn't a thing, because I always tell my friends that our generation was the guinea pig generation in regards to like the GNCs of the world, the supplementations of the world. Our coaches were giving us like creatine, amongst other things. So if there weren't sports nutritionists behind these marketing ad campaigns, the Mark McGuire's of the world, the Sammy Sosa of the world, hitting home runs and stuff, who the hell was pushing these? Who was behind it if scientists weren't?
Well, mainly marketing people, to be honest. And that's one of, you know, that's been one of our big goals. It's, you know, in fact, the marketing people are, they're a very talented group. They could sell you anything. But I've always taught, I mean, we know a lot of these big companies, and I always say your best marketing is science. If you could get someone who can communicate science in a fun way, in an easy to understand way, then that's a home run. That's gold. And so initially companies like, you know, I don't know. We don't need scientists. We've been selling this shit forever. Why do we need you guys? And it's like, because you know why? The consumer is going to start asking for science. And that's what's happened. Now consumers want more information. They're just not going to buy it stuff anymore. So we've been able to partner with a lot of different companies. And interestingly, the science industry, because science is a business too, the science industry, the business of science, the business of doing research, has actually, you know, had a nice little uptick because of sports nutrition. So now people get studies funded, and it helps, you know, students graduate and things like that. So, it's changed. It's a lot different than it was 10 to 20 years ago. It's definitely a lot better than it was 10 to 20 years ago. And I remember, were you guys even alive in the 1980s? Were you guys alive?
Yeah,
we were both born in 82.
All right, well, in the 1980s, I remember, this is when I was in college, and even, let me go back even further. In the 1970s, I was a kid, and one of my uncles was a bodybuilder, and he would take all sorts of stuff. He's like, and I like, he had these bottles of amino acid tablets from Weider, Joe Weider brand.
Yeah.
And I'd open them up. I'm like, man, this stuff stinks. And he's like, you know what? If it stinks more, it works better. So I was like, oh, okay. And then the protein powders back then, awful. He's like, it's got to taste bad for it to work. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, I didn't know. So, but now everything tastes great because of food science and food technology. But it's just funny how back then it's like, it didn't taste like crap. It wasn't worth anything.
That was the science.
Jose, was there a breakthrough year? Like, you know, you mentioned you started in 2003. You know, you probably obviously started with 40, 50 people. Was there a year where just the attendance just exploded?
Yeah, actually, it's taken a while. It's only been in the last 2 or 3 years where we've had four. It's probably going to get close to 500. And I think that might be our limit for a while, because what makes an academic society grow are students. Students have to graduate, and it's not like suddenly they're a student. So this sort of four-year cycle, every 4 years we get a little bit more students, and then they become professors and they have students. So it's been a slow growth, mainly because there's just not many people who actually do sports nutrition science. But there's a lot of fans of it, you know, we've got a lot of people who love it. So, but we need more people studying.
Yeah. Tristan and I, well, I don't want to speak for Tristan. I was with him when I first heard of you. We were interviewing Dr. Corey Peacock, and, you know, shout out to Corey. You know, he at the time he was working with the Black Zillions and MMA team for the UFC.
Yes.
And then once again, you were brought up with former world champion Chris Algieri, who, you know, still is a combat athlete and a fighter and educated in his own right. Is this something that, you know, both Corey and both Chris being like, you know, Chris is still in his career, like competing. When you're at the ISSN, do you see a lot of like in their career, like combat athletes upskilling and developing themselves, or are they more the coaching aspect?
It's more the coaching aspect. And I think what's really cool and unique about Chris is that he might be the only combat athlete who is formally educated in the sciences. And I think that's why he has such a unique niche, because not only is he a world-class combat athlete, but he actually understands the science, which I can't think of a single, let's face it, most combat athletes, well, unless they come from a wrestling background, they've all gone to college. But most of them who don't have a wrestling background, I think they're barely out of high school.
Yeah.
So the fact that Chris has a master's degree is actually rather amazing. So, you know, his brain works, so he doesn't yet have brain damage, let's hope. I tell him, you know, maybe you should stop getting punched. It's not good for your brain. but yeah, it's mostly we get a lot of personal trainers, a lot of coaches, and then secondarily we get a lot of dietitians and students, and then maybe 20% of our audience are PhDs and medical doctors.
Yeah, let's rip into a bit of nutrition stuff now. You know, you spoke about creatine before, and I've read a couple of things about creatine, especially around brain injuries and also memory. Can you just share with us some of the things that you've learned about creatine recently?
Yeah, creatine has got to be one of the coolest, not just supplements, it's just really the science behind it is super cool. And, you know, when I teach about sports nutrition in my class, even though a lot of people focus on physique stuff, you know, outside of academics, there's a lot of people who really don't care. They're really more into performance. And they say, I don't really need creatine. I don't want to gain weight, even if it's muscle weight. And I always tell them, you know what? Forget all the exercise stuff. What if you just took it for your brain, took it for memory, took it to protect your brain from any kind of injury? And to me, that might be the best argument for creatine, that it's good for your head. Wow. And the data on it is actually really cool. And in fact, oddly enough, the people who are helped most by it are vegetarians or vegans. Why? Because they don't eat any meat. So if you don't eat meat, you're not getting creatine. And that alone, you know, forget the muscle stuff. If you want to help your brain, you know, take your omega-3 fatty acids, take your creatine. That stuff helps a lot. And not to mention all the other clinical disorders creatine might help. You know, neuromuscular disorders, Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. The data on creatine helping clinical, these various clinical maladies is actually rather amazing. And for us in sports nutrition, I'll be honest, when I see a study on creatine that deals with performance, I'm like, why? This is kind of boring. Why do we need another performance study? It works. It works really well.
Wow.
You know, the clinical stuff is super cool. But as sports nutritionists, I'll be honest, we're kind of bored with it. It's like, okay, well, we know it makes you bigger, faster, stronger. Okay. Unless it's on like a unique sport. Let's say it's like rock climbing. Yeah, I haven't seen a study on rock climbing. But if you can climb the face of a mountain faster on creatine. Oh, that's kind of cool. Okay, well, wow, that's pretty cool. But, you know, do I need creatine helps you do more weight on squat and bench press? No, not really. That's been done like 500 times.
So the one thing I never – thanks for asking that question, TK. I never heard the creatine and the connection with brain. So is it – you're saying that the creatine – in terms of the brain, could you share with us what it's doing, why it's helping it? But also, do you remember in the late 90s there was an American football player. He went to Ohio State. He played in Minnesota, Corey Stringer. He was from where I'm from. All pro. He was a big dude, 6'5", probably 300 pounds. And he died in spring training. And I think the initial cause, they attributed it to kidney failure due to he was taking a lot of creatine. So I remember that was one negative, and that was, geez, that was over 20 years ago, I'm sure now. But is there connections with creatine and kidney issues? And then also, could you share insight on the specifics of what the creatine does for brain function?
Yeah, well, first I do remember the Corey Stringer case with the Vikings, and it had nothing to do with creatine. Oddly enough, it had to do with he basically had a heat stroke. I think his body temperature went like almost near 110. I mean, it was ungodly high. Wow. So it was really a simple case of, you know, you should probably let these guys cool off. These guys are huge. Have them drink a lot of fluid so he doesn't have heat stroke. And here's the ironic part. Creatine actually helps with thermoregulation in the heat. And a lot of people aren't familiar with that data. It's you actually do better in hot environments if you take creatine.
Wow.
So you know, one of those sort of not well-known facts. Now, your other question, remind me.
With the brain activity.
Yeah. Well, I think this originated from, there was some data from the emergency room kids from age, like infants to age 18. They come in with traumatic brain injury into the hospital. And I remember reading this because I wasn't familiar with this data several years back. And I'm like, wow. So these kids come in and they're given creatine or a placebo. I mean, basically, what hospital gives anyone creatine? So the fact that a hospital is giving someone creatine, I'm like, wow, this is really rather odd. Hmm. And they found that kids coming in with traumatic brain injury, so this could be car accidents, could be falling. It's, you know, you can't control brain injury in humans, so it's whatever, whoever comes in. They found that those taking creatine, not only did they get out of the hospital quicker, but they suffered much fewer side effects from the brain injury if they were on creatine. Now, the question is, well, how does it do that? And the sort of the quick, dirty answer is nobody's really sure. We just know it does. And there's really cool data in animals showing that. And this is kind of cruel. I'm not a big fan of, you know, torturing animals by any means. But if you induce head trauma into an animal, it's typically it's a rat. And people don't give rats ass about rats, I guess. But So they injure the rat's brain, you know, and how do you injure a rat's, you know, do head injury in a rat? Well, you hit it. I mean, you hit it on the head. But you hit it with a fixed amount of force. Rats that have had brain injuries in their own creatine suffer less trauma to the brain. And it might have something to do with the fact that creatine acts as an energy substrate for the brain and that by providing it, it helps your brain recover. Nobody's really quite sure, but the fact of the matter is, the data shows it protects you from traumatic brain injury. And in fact, if you box, if you do mixed martial arts, if you play American football, if you play rugby, if you play soccer, if you play anything where your brain gets jostled, you should take creatine to protect your freaking brain. And that's really, to me, the best argument. Forget all the muscle mass stuff. You'll gain muscle if you eat well, work out hard. But man, this stuff helps your brain, and that's super cool.
Jose, how do we take it? And if we do take it, do we have to take it by itself or can we mix it with things?
You can mix it with anything. And I would suggest for people who have not taken it, take like 3 to 5 grams per day and just stay on it. You know, treat it like it's a multivitamin. Just take it every day. Oh. I mean, I have some pills in my pantry. I'll take like a couple pills a day. I don't obsess over how much I take. I take some pills here, take some, you know, I've been taking it somewhat regularly for the last 10 to 20 years, or actually probably longer than that. And to me, it's just, you know, just one of many pills or powders I take. You know, to me, it's like taking a protein shake after I work out. I just do it.
Yeah. Is there a difference between the pill and the powder at all?
No, it's just some people like pills because they know the dosing. Whereas with powder, you got to scoop it, mix it with a shake or something, but it's sort of personal preference.
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, www.divisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show. Jose, could you share with us some insights on some, because the fitness industry, the wellness industry, nutrition, it's constantly evolving. And because of that, we're constantly faced with like fads, whether it's a fad diet or a fad style of training, et cetera, et cetera. In your experience in, you know, what you've seen so far in your career, talk a little bit about maybe some fads that you have experienced through that people were thinking that were like the hot, like the way of the future, and then they've been proven to be wrong, and then maybe put your visionary cap on and predict some of those that are hot right now that'll maybe go to the wayside.
Well, you know, particularly with fads, and I'll focus on sports nutrition or nutrition, I have seen, going back again before you guys were even born, and this is what's kind of funny, I've lived through a lot of this, so a lot of people aren't familiar with it. In the 60s and 70s, the way we were taught to eat was there were four basic food groups: meat and poultry, dairy, grains, and then fruits and vegetables. So you had four basic groups. And actually, it probably makes the most sense out of all the stupid governmental recommendations. And then, fast forward, I think the 80s, where the food pyramid comes out. And then the food pyramid just really screwed everything up. It's like, what? So now we got to eat a bucket full of bread, but don't eat much fat, even though there might be healthy fat. And then they put nuts with protein. I'm like, nuts with protein? That's really weird. And it was just a total mess. So that sort of the faddishness coming from the federal government in terms of how we eat is kind of silly. And then sort of the subcategories of diets that come from that. In the 1980s, it was all low fat this, low fat that. If you eat fat, you get fat. So let's eat more carbs. And then everyone got fat because they were eating more calories.
Yeah.
And then Atkins came along and says, you know what? Maybe you should eat a lot of protein, not so much carbs, which oddly enough might have been is sort of the tipping point where now we are finding out that there are multiple diets that work for people and that the number one issue with maintaining good body weight is not the diet, but is compliance or adherence. If you can stick to a particular way of eating, regardless of what it is, it seems to be the best thing. That's number one. Number two, if you look at these diets, in a way they're all sort of faddish, but if you look at these diets, the one commonality they have is that you're not eating junk. So basically, stick to a diet, don't eat junk. So if you like to eat poultry all the time, eat poultry. If you like to eat fish, eat fish. If you want to go vegan, go vegan. But don't eat junk. Don't eat calorically dense food. So that would be what? Pies, cakes, cookies, crap. I mean, sodas, you know, sugar-filled sodas. So I've seen sort of this weird evolution. So now we're at the point where I tell people, just eat food. I mean, eat regular food. Don't eat processed crap. I mean, there are processed foods that are good for you. I mean, like, for instance, whey protein technically is processed because the protein has been removed from milk.
Yeah.
But it's a great processed food. So, but I'm talking about foods that tend to be high in sugar and high in fat. And those typically are desserts. And that's calorically dense foods that are low in protein are the ones that tend to be the most problematic because it's just easy to overeat. And so you see that faddishness. And then, you know, on the training side, you know what's interesting about training? Because I did my PhD in muscle physiology and I focused on muscle hypertrophy. What I've noticed is that the same questions that I asked in the 80s and 90s are the exact same questions they're asking now, meaning they haven't come up with any different answers, particularly when it comes to hypertrophy. So I'm thinking, wow, has the field moved that slow in muscle physiology? And maybe the answer is yes. It's muscle physiology moves slow. Sports nutrition moves fast. It's sort of like sports nutrition is a Ferrari. You know, muscle physiology is like riding a bike. And that's one of the reasons I love sports nutrition is it changes so fast. You know, the muscle stuff, the training stuff, it's like, how much does it really change? Well, it changes based on fat, you know. Some people, you know, they espouse, you know, you got to avoid certain exercises. Don't do squats. Some people say you got to do certain exercises all the time. Everyone in the training world sort of falls into a camp of they have their favorite exercises. They have their exercises they hate. And it's sort of odd. I was just finished reading an article from a somewhat well-known, I guess, trainer in our field. And she said, basically, she was saying how steady state cardio is dead. No one needs to do it. And forgetting that the topic is steady state cardio, I've always found it odd that a trainer would eliminate an entire form of exercise because they have a personal bias against it. It's like the focus should be on the client, on the athlete, and not your personal bias. There might be people who like doing steady state cardio and people who hate doing high intensity interval training or vice versa. You always got to cater it, and to just eliminate an entire category is just stupid. And I see this a lot in training. People, they either fall in love with an exercise or they eliminate an exercise, and that's sort of how they get their shtick. You know, luckily in sports nutrition, it's easy to get a shtick because there's so much new stuff to learn. You know, you don't have to say, well, you know, I'm only for eating paleo or eating ketogenic. I mean, it's, how about this? Go for whatever works. I mean, paleo works, whatever the hell paleo is, do that. If you like eating fat till you're blue in the face, eat fat till you're blue in the face. But many things work, and it's all about compliance.
How much, you know, we had Dr. Tom Bellella, who you know, a few weeks ago on the show, and he talked extensively on food sensitivity testing. Have you got into much of that, Doctor?
You know, what's interesting is I actually got tested myself. The science was, I mean, the science is kind of, I mean, it's sort of, I'll call it lukewarm. And so I got tested. And there were a lot of common foods that I ate, you know, lemons. I'm like, wow, I'm sensitive to lemons. I'm somewhat sensitive to coffee. Give me a break. I drink coffee like it's, you know, like a a guy in the desert drinks water.
Yeah.
So there were just a lot of foods that said, well, you're super sensitive. It might inflame you. And for a while, I'm like, okay, let me try to do this and eliminate some of these foods. And it didn't friggin' matter. Yeah, dang it. And I ain't eliminating coffee, for Christ's sake. So then kiss my butt. No, unless you're extremely, you know, people know if they're extremely sensitive to a food. The science just isn't there. I mean, I was hopeful. I was like, yeah, I'll give it a shot. But I'm just not convinced.
And Jose, we like pointing our clients and pointing our listeners in directions when we have experts like yourself on the show, because with so many people out, you know, Instagram, social media, there's information coming from everywhere. Where would you point, you know, on a short list to our clients listening to this, where would you point them when they're inquiring about what websites to look on for, you know, the right foods to eat, the right style of training, science-based evidence in regards to health and nutrition? Where would you tell them to go?
That's a good question, because I've been asked that a lot. And it's not like there's a place or one place to go to. So it's not so much places, it's or websites. It's you got to look for certain people. And I think that's the key. It's the people, not the websites. And to me, the best place to start is if you go to the ISSN website. It's ISSN.net, www.ISSN.net. And look at the people on the advisory board of ISSN. And, you know, it's a small group. It's like 20 to 30 people. But within that group, they have their tentacles out, and they know everybody in the industry. So to me, this is where networking is so important. You might know just one or two people, but those one or two people might know 30 other people who are experts in a particular area. So to me, that would be the best way. Unfortunately, it's not really a website per se, other than, you know, I always recommend reading science, but let's face it. For most people, reading science articles is boring as hell. They're like, yeah, I can't read this stuff. It's dry. It sucks. It's not, you know, it's not fun to read. And I'm like, yeah, you're right, because that's how scientists write. They write in a very dry, rigid style, because that's the way it's meant to be in science. So, Journal of the International Society of Sports Nutrition. The website is JISSN.com. Actually, it has a ton of information there on anything related to sports nutrition. A ton of stuff. You could do a search on that journal. For you type in essential amino acids, a ton of articles. Type in creatine, a ton of articles. Type in protein, ton of stuff. So, I would highly recommend that.
Yeah, Jose, can you give us a little bit of advice? So, for example, let's stick with a whey protein. So, if I want to choose a good whey protein, in terms of choosing it and looking for things on a label, are there things that I should be looking for and things that I should be, if it does come up, I should be avoiding that supplement?
You know, whey protein, here's the thing, because it's a commodity, almost all the whey protein that's sold, particularly in the United States, is all pretty high quality. I would suggest people stick to the very well-known brands, whether it's Dymatize or GNC or you name it, or Optimum. All of that whey protein is actually very good, and it's really a question of flavor. You know, do you like it unflavored or do you like it flavored? Because the quality of the stuff now in 2017 it surpasses anything we saw 10, 20 years ago. So to me, the quality part isn't the issue. To me, it's always a taste issue now, because everything tastes good now. Just, you know, whether you want, you know, pure whey protein or whey protein isolate, which has, you know, slightly more protein, slightly less, you know, lactose or... it's really a personal preference. I mean, to me, just regular whey protein concentrate is fine. It tastes good. I mean, to me, taste is the number one factor. If it doesn't taste good, I'm not going to consume it, no matter how good it is for me. If it tastes like crap, I'm not going to do it.
Jose, did you happen to watch, What the Health? I had to bring it up, man, because, dude, I had a client I had a client call me after she watched it and said, Johnny, I'm going to go vegan now. And I go, why? And she was like, I just watched this documentary and I just went, oh shit, this is going to be, there's going to be some backlash to this one. So maybe share with us a little bit of how you, if you saw it, if you haven't seen it, what's your take on it?
I actually watched the first part of it because I couldn't sit through the whole thing.
Exactly.
I'll be honest.
Yeah.
It's like, it basically was a, how will I describe it? It was a promotion of a vegan diet masked with pseudoscience. So this is a great example of just pure stupid bullshit that people believe. And, you know, does it bother me? I kind of find it entertaining. And here's the thing. When people believe it, I'm like, okay, they believe it. I mean, you know, there's a sucker born every minute. You know, I think P.T. Barnum said that. I forget who said it. But yeah, there's a sucker born every minute. So we, as people who work in the science field, have to do a better job in educating people. But the thing is, when you're, at least in the U.S., you know, when you got 330 million people, there's going to be a lot of dumbasses, you know? Australia has what, like 5 people?
I think like 20 million.
Not many. Yeah. Not many at all.
So you're like 22 million, I think. Yeah, 22 or 20 million Australians. So you're basically the size of Florida.
Yeah,
that's true.
So, but even then, in a country that's small like Australia, you're still going to have a lot of people who want to believe stuff like this. So, And I say, you know what? There's room for stupid people. There's room for smart people. we just won't mix together. but it was a stupid ad. That was just one of the dumbest.
Yeah, it's always when these things come out, like the sugar. When being a trainer and a coach, when the sugar film came out, and it's like, it's almost like we need to be ready for this and have our guard up, kind of just expecting this pseudo BS. Because clients have no idea.
Yeah. You know what actually is somewhat popular here was the bulletproof coffee. Was that?
Dave Asprey. Your boy Dave Asprey.
Let's put a shitload of butter in coffee. Let's ruin the coffee. God dang it.
People are still doing it. Like the CrossFitters.
Well, that's a whole other topic. That's the only sport, if you want to call it sport, where people, okay, how many pec tears were there at the last CrossFit competition? I was reading about this recently. There was like 20-something pec tears, pectoral, I think it was pectoralis major. They tore their pec major. What other sport do people compete in where you get 23 pec tears in one competition?
Wow.
The answer is none.
Yeah.
None. They're getting pec tears from doing exercise. They're not even competing in a event. They're doing exercise, which tells you this. It tells you that the concept of progressive overload, the concept of simple progression, simple specificity does not exist in that sport. Does not exist because you should not be tearing your pecs. I mean, you know, American football or even rugby, I mean, these sports are much more brutal and they're not tearing their pecs. They're fine. Why? Because they actually train for a sport, you know, so.
Yeah.
All right, Jose, last topic before we let you go, because we've taken a lot of your time. Protein. Now, protein, do we overeat protein? Like, some people are going, you should eat 2 times your body weight per pound, 1.2. Are we eating too much protein?
I think most people are under-eating protein, and I'll qualify that. Most people who exercise are under-eating protein. People who don't exercise, honestly, I don't really care about them, so let's just talk about people who exercise.
Yeah.
I think the baseline protein intake for people who work out should be 1 gram of protein per pound. If you like the metric system, you know, 2.2 grams per kilo of protein. That should be the baseline. Will it help if you consume more? Interestingly, if the goal is to gain muscle mass, it doesn't seem to help to consume more. However, if the goal is to lose fat mass, it might help. In fact, my own study showed that when you overfeed on protein, you tend to lose fat. You may not gain more muscle, but you tend to lose fat, which, you know, most people are kind of cool. They're like, yeah, I'll lose some fat. What the hell? I actually think people are under-eating it, and particularly when you're dealing with older populations and you're dealing with sarcopenia, you know, the age-related loss of skeletal muscle mass, they tend to definitely underfeed on protein. It's one of those things where, you know, as people get older, they tend to move less. They tend to eat less protein. It's like you need to move more. Keep moving. And you keep eating, you know, eat. It doesn't have to be beef. I mean, if people have this thing about red meat, fish, eat chicken, drink milk, drink whey. So it's, I don't think people are overfeeding it. I mean, I know there's a lot of clinical nutritionists out there who keep saying, "Yeah, we eat too much protein." I'm like, baloney. We do not. I mean, it's if you're dealing with athletes who are quite large, I mean, they need to, in essence, force feed themselves protein because it's hard to get it through food. They got to get it through supplements. So, you know, definitely not under eating.
Would you say so? That's so. I'm 35. I'm 5'11", 185. I work out, played sports my whole life. Probably 9% body fat. I don't supplement protein only because I equate it. Back in the day, I would take it like in powder, and it would always make my stomach. I feel like it would always make my stomach hurt and like bloated. So for the last 5 years, I just get it in my diet. Do you recommend that? Is it feasible or possible to get the protein requirements without supplementing it?
Yeah, if you can do it with without supplementing, then that's even better. Because you know what? Food tastes better than protein shakes. Okay. I mean, that's just sort of really the reality of it. Now, what you describe is actually interesting because the more research I've done, there's always a subset of like 5 to 10% of my research subjects who say, you know, I just, my belly just feels bloated and I get GI distress. I'm like, you know, that's, I'd say, you know, milk-based proteins, whether it's whey or whatnot, you know, maybe it's just not good for you. And it seems like these people who are sensitive to milk-based proteins, the vegetarian protein seemed to work better for them, whether it's pea protein, rice protein, maybe even that hemp, even though there's no data on hemp.
Yeah.
Seems to, you know, sit well in their stomach and then their GI tract better. So, but again, for me, it's if you can do it eating fish, meat, chicken, whatever, you know, I'd say do it that way. It's a question of what works for you. And if that works for you, I would stick to it. You know, the one thing I like about protein shakes is after I work out, I'm not hungry. It's like I can't just sit down and eat. So I drink like a 20 to 40 gram shake. And then maybe a couple hours later, I'm hungry. So that's why I like it because I do one shake a day and it's always after exercise. Other than that, I'm not someone who's like, oh, I think I'll just have a shake because I like the taste. It's like, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. I'd rather have a, you know, steak or give me some sushi or something instead.
Yeah. Jose, have you done much experiments with probiotics at all?
We are actually in the middle of a probiotic study at my university, at Nova Southeastern University in South Florida. And we haven't finished it, so I can't even tell you what preliminary data looks like. But the idea is that if you can change your gut bacteria via probiotics, it'll make you healthier. And there's some preliminary data in animals and maybe even some obese people that if you give them probiotics or make their gut bacteria healthier, they'll lose body fat. Now, the challenge I have is I'm dealing with trained subjects. So these people are already healthy to begin with. So if you're giving healthy people probiotics, will it help them lose fat? My initial guess is that the answer is no, because they're doing other things. They're exercising. They're all eating well. So it's not like their diet's going to change. So maybe their gut bacteria is already good. And maybe trained people aren't the best people to study when it comes to probiotics. But then again, I only care about trained people. I'm not going to study sedentary slobs. So, you know, I think we'll have the study done. We'll present it at the ISSN conference next year in Clearwater Beach. But right now, it's all preliminary.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm really looking forward to that because I've been really into the microbiome. And then reading about the vagus nerve in regards to like our emotions and our behaviors and how we feel. And just recently, I ended up going to the doctor. I kind of had the flu and they tried giving me an antibiotic and I refused. I said no, just because of what I'm reading about. It talks about you take an antibiotic and your gut flora just totally just, it's just ruined for a long, long time. And then I went down that rabbit hole of like how us as humans, we've only like eating muscle meat, or we used to eat organ meat and now we only eat muscle meat. And then like there's certain, you know, probiotics in our stomach that we need, like the things from tendons and the meat around the organs and all for overall health. So it's so complicated.
Yeah. You know, it's, my father was a gastroenterologist. He was a medical doctor. And as a kid, I'll tell you this, and looking back, I'm like, holy shit, Antibiotics were given out like candy. I mean, if you were sick, take an antibiotic. I mean, luckily I worked out a lot. As a kid, I did martial arts as a kid, so I was constantly moving around, exercising, training. So it never really affected my body composition. But I've always wondered how that affected my gut flora, because I used a lot of it as a kid. Because I was, I get sick a lot, and usually because of the change of weather. I grew up near Washington, D.C., and every time the weather would go from hot to cold, I'd get sick. It was just, that's why I like Florida, because it's always hot. But just like you now, unless I am deathly ill, I'm not going to take an antibiotic because of that. And I think people are starting to go that route now. It's like, okay, unless you're just dying, unless you're going to have a severe infection, let your body fight. And then if it gets really bad, then taking the antibiotic is probably better because you don't want to get an infection. So, it's really interesting. And, everything is so preliminary now. And I think for now we're going to find the best information or the best effects of this kind of stuff in the obese, in diabetics, in honestly, in people who just don't exercise. Because I think, out of all the stuff we do, the number one equalizer, the number one thing, the most important behavior is exercise. If you don't exercise, and I tell this to a lot of people who want nutrition advice, I always say, if you don't work out, then this is all pointless. I'm not going to tell you how to eat because you got to exercise. Mm. That is the number one behavior. You've got to work out.
All right. Jose, last question. Now, you're a big paddler. You've spoken about exercise. Me and Johnny always talk about moving and exercise as well. When we finish, what is your recommended go-to post-workout meal?
I would highly recommend this. Whether you're a strength power athlete or an endurance athlete, post-workout, the critical thing to get in is protein, because I think protein is the most difficult macronutrient to get enough of. And for smaller people, I'd say a 20-gram dose is good enough. For larger people, go 40 grams or higher. I weigh about 175, 180 pounds, so I get about a 20, depending on the shake. I just put random shakes in my ice chest. I'll get like 25, 30 grams of protein post-workout, and then I'll eat a meal later. So to me, that's the most important thing. If you do a lot of high-volume endurance stuff, if you're out there for 2 or 3 hours, then not just protein, but calories. So you got to get something with a lot of sugar in it just to get the calories. And, so depending on the volume, if the volume's high, get calories and protein. If the volume is not that high, get protein. And then make sure you eat good food afterwards.
All right. Before we let you go, everyone get following Jose on Twitter. He's pretty active. Jose Antonio, PhD, or as he's mentioned on the show before, check out the ISSN, www.sportsnutritionsociety.org. Anything else that you kind of want people to check out there, Jose?
No, just make sure you go on to ISSN.net and check out the conference schedule. And hopefully you can come to one of them. We're going to have we don't yet have one in Australia, but we'll have conferences in England, Brazil, Colombia, Canada, and then, of course, all over the U.S.
And you said Clearwater next June?
Yes, our national meeting is in Clearwater Beach, Florida. Clearwater Beach, Florida, June 7th to the 9th. So make sure you guys are there and get ready to paddle in the ocean.
Definitely, man. We'll take you up on that. We appreciate you stopping by the Vision Board, man. This was fun. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it, guys.
Johnny, Jose Antonio.
Doctor, man. That was fun, man. He's like you said off air, he's one of these guys that will not bend a certain way to accommodate somebody else's beliefs. Like, he knows what he's doing, and he really believes in his movement and mission, and the ISSN is living proof of that.
Yeah, I like the fact that he's, he doesn't try to complicate things too much. Like, his answers were very kind of specific, and it's very understandable what he's trying to say. Because nutrition, as we spoke about when we were off air, it's one of those, it's so complicated. So I think you did kind of help us out, and those last kind of 5 or 6 Q&A questions were fantastic because it gives us a little bit more peace of mind and different things that we can help apply to our clients, and then hopefully other people that aren't our clients also got some great information.
Excellent, man. And then also, what we are able to do now with things, like the things that I'm blown away on is the creatine conversation you brought up in relation to brain activity, when he was mentioned adherence in relation to nutrition. And so in the future, when we have these conversations off air or with our clients, like you said, or with upcoming guests on the vision board, it kind of gives us a new spider web to go down in terms of being inquisitive about topics that before this conversation, I had no idea existed. And guys listening, I think that is a huge take-home point of platforms like this, learning.
Yeah. And I think it's also great that we've got Chris Argyri coming on in a couple of weeks.
Your boy.
It's actually delayed a couple of weeks, but it's probably worked out better because we didn't get to go through everything that we had to want to talk about with Jose. So then we can kind of, that can
further, segue.
Yeah,
segue right into
straight
it.
Into
with and Chris. Dude, the kid stays in fight shape year round. Have you seen it? I'm sure you follow him on it.
Yeah,
he follows us. But he's always taking those photos with, like, I saw him recently in a ring. He was, I think, at
a boxing bag.
He was at Tony's.
Yeah.
Yeah, shoulder game on point. Is he preparing for a fight or is he retired?
Yeah, I think he's trying to. Last time I spoke to him, he said he was trying to fight.
This guy's a savage. Guys, Chris is the guy that beat Miguel Cotto.
No, it was my bad. Provnikov. What's his name?
Ruslan Provotnikov.
Yeah.
He fought Cotto, though, right?
No. That was Austin Trout.
Yeah, I'm getting the vision board interviews mixed up. But Chris is an educated nutritionist, combat fighter. Very like Dr. Jose said, one of the rare combat athletes who's actually educated to that level. So we could have conversations now that branch out because of this one we just had. And Dr. Jose, man, we could have spoke to him for hours.
But I hope that is sort of where, you know, the ISSN does take things in terms of educating athletes as well. Because I think it's fantastic. They've got a big advantage over the rest of the world in the fact that they are high-performance athletes. And if they could mix education with experience, do you know what I mean, how much more they could touch? Because the way of the world is people believe authorities. So if you've got a big reputation or you're a movie star or you're a celebrity, if the celebrity said something correct in nutrition, people will believe it.
Or incorrect. If the celebrity just says
Yeah, exactly right. They've got such a big influence over people.
Their word is bond.
That, you know, so exactly right. So while the athlete, unfortunately, you know, an athlete's got a small amount of window, just say 10 years, if they have injury free.
To compete.
And also where their celebrityism is at a high level. Because unfortunately, with the way of the world, once most people retire, if you don't go into media, you usually spat out the back. And no one really associates, you know what I mean? Like your popularity, you're not the same popularity as you were when you were world champions, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know what, man? You just made me think. The one thing I think Australia does well with their pro athlete, now we'll use specifically the NRL and the soccer, the A-League, is that I learned recently that the Young Bucks coming up, right before they get to the show, the big show, is that they're required to educate themselves and they get an option of whether they do it in fitness or they do it in like a Cert 3 and 4 sort of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of what it is. I think you're talking about the under-20s for the NRL.
So are they required to educate
themselves?
They are
required to do a course or a trade or something like that.
Okay.
But it's one of those things that I still don't think the players are taking it very seriously right now.
Imagine though, like to piggyback on your initial thought, if like the ISSN and the advantages that you said that they had with sports performance in high level athletes, imagine if Chris, you take a guy like Chris and he'll have like this carryover effect with young boxers young MMA fighters or young football players who will then be so interested in not only performing at the highest level, but the understanding of why they are performing at the highest level.
Yeah.
Because that's something that, you know, we as athletes, former athletes, we're not taught. We're taught to just go A to B, let's get it done, go to the whistle. But imagine if the sport would evolve, and this is any sport, because the players are evolving their minds and educating themselves on, oh, I'm doing this because of that. I can optimize my performance even better by doing this and that. I think that would be a pretty interesting concept too, to kind of like offer to like the younger generations coming up. You know, the ISSN doing it with the coaching perspective.
I agree, because the combat sports does scare me.
The head trauma.
That people are cutting 20 pounds or equivalent of 9 kilos of body or water weight the day before an actual fight.
You know, big fight like, coming up.
When you think about the trauma that's just about to be inflicted on someone's head, for someone to be dehydrated or to have been in a dehydrated state 2 days before they actually compete, that's got to be the worst thing that I've ever heard.
You've heard, I mean, we shared space with Boom Boom and we talked about Dooku Kim. And in 1982, the reason why boxing went from 15 to 12, along with these other extraneous variables of this 15-round war taking place in Las Vegas in the desert in Caesar's Palace in 100-degree heat, But the reason why Dooku Kim fought a brilliant fight, and after the 15th round, he never got up. He passed away. Very famous documented fight is because of that dehydration on the swelling of the brain. Because they weren't in 82, they didn't know, oh, I'm dehydrating, I'm fighting, I'm cutting, and I'm taking all these headshots.
Yeah.
It's a big, big thing, man.
I think cutting that drastic amount of weight is overrated. When you have a look at someone like Rob Whittaker, he's fighting 15 pounds heavier, and he's fighting in, what, he went from 170 to 185.
Rob's cutting still 25 pounds.
He's 200, he's told us that he walks at.
Did you say 215?
So 200. So you've virtually cut 15 pounds, which is a lot better than the 30.
Yeah.
And when you think about...
Weidman walks around at 220, 225.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And fights 185.
That is so crazy.
Did you see the new weight classes?
The biggest thing is that, you know, over the last... You know, obviously Pacquiao lost his last fight, but realistically, he's been a welterweight for the last 8 years. He's cut no weight.
Where'd he start, though? Do you remember?
Yeah, I know. Flyweight. The last division. Yeah. But look at the performance difference once he went up. I think he fought a lot better once he got up to that higher weight. Same as Floyd Mayweather.
Yeah, Rob's a great example of that, though, because... if you guys remember when Rob came out of the house, the tough Smashes house, the reality show, he was fighting at welterweight. Mm-hmm. And when he lost that fight to Wonderboy Thompson, his last loss, and said he was going to 185, the media were like, what is this kid doing? 185, there's killers up there. What's happened since 185? He hasn't lost. He's become a champion. It's because he walks around it that way, closer to that weight than 170. Did you see the press release yesterday on the new weight classes?
No.
I'd have to pull my phone out, but yeah, the UFC or one of the commissions, Las Vegas, just announced so right now we have 135, 140, 135, 45, 55, 70, 85, 205, and heavyweight. They just announced a 95 weight class and a 225 weight class.
To cut the middle between...
The light heavyweight and heavyweight. Because that, in my opinion, and I think also to cut the middleweight... 185 to 205 is such a huge jump. That's a 20-pound jump. So they're putting one in between there. And
makes sense. I think it'll probably stop like fights like Brock Lesnar and what's his name? John Jones actually happening now if there's a big gap.
A 225 gap.
I feel like, well, it's probably more responsible if John Jones went to those middle weight classes before he jumped all the way back up to heavyweight. Because it just seems like a very drastic move on his part to give up 60 pounds and just want to fight him straight away. Maybe just give him an opportunity to kind of test himself at a higher weight.
I don't think that's ever going to go down, but John better be worried about DC tomorrow.
Yeah, I like DC.
Yeah, that's tomorrow, man. We could do a whole show on that. I was thinking about doing a Facebook Live at my house when we're watching it. We'll see what happens. But yeah, interesting times with the weight cuts and with all the studies coming out on CTE and brain injuries and, you know, a lot of good conversations to be had with more guests like Jose Antonio.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like we mentioned at the top of the show, we'll continue the chat with Chris because, you know, being someone that's in a traumatic sport like himself, it's going to be a great perspective to see what his take is on how he uses things like creatine and what he's noticed in terms of memory, especially as he gets older. You know, I think he's 30 now and he's not 21 anymore. So
very
interesting to see what's evolved in his life in terms of nutrition as well.
Yeah, man. He's really open to, we'll see how deep we could go with those waters in regards to the brain prevention and injuries and all things health and performance. But yeah, Algeria will be up in a couple of weeks.
All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in to the show. Johnny, before we leave, social media.
Follow me, guys. Johnny Stofko. I appreciate you. New YouTube channel, Johnny Stofko. Subscribe. How about you, TK?
I'm at Tristan Cannell Fitness or Tristan Cannell across all the different social media networks, or if you want to get in touch with both of us at the same time, just send us an email, info@thevisionboardpodcast.com. We'd love to hear from you, so please do get in touch. Next week on the show, just bringing up the schedule, we got a couple of good ones. We got John Meadow, who is a big bodybuilder, another nutrition sort of take, and then Brian McKenzie, who's all connected with guys like Kelly Starrett and some other guys that we've had on the show too. So B-Max is someone that we've had highly requested. So, yeah, it's going to be a great show.
Yeah, dude. You know, July's coming to an end. August, we're going to be bringing it. September, we're going to be bringing it. Make sure you stay tuned. As you can already tell, the Vision Board is taking the game up. Stay in contact. Stay in touch with us, man. We appreciate you.
All right, guys. Till next time, stay safe, and we'll check you soon.
Be good, guys.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working harder. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.